We got here. They delivered right in town.
Well, we live in the house. It's now the Peck Rose Funeral Chapel.
Is that right?
First home in Chelan, and that was convenient to the school. So we enjoyed that house.
We're probably giving too much away, but were you still in grade school when you came here, or
no, I was in the sixth grade when I moved to Chelan, 10 years old, and in the sixth grade.
Okay. We've talked to a lot of people in the month of Heritage about going to school in the teens and the 20s, but not too many about going to school here at Chelan in the 30s. So, what was the grade school like?
Well, I was in what they called junior high, which was in the same building as the high school. Sixth, seventh, and eighth grade were in that building. The grade school was in the building behind. But it's now just at the foot of the hill there as you come down whatever street that is.
Yeah, Bradley Street.
And Bradley Street. And so the junior high and high school were both in the building without the additions that have been made since.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was a good school, and it was a big traumatic event to me because I came from a real small country school in Ephrata where we still had outdoor plumbing and so forth, and classes of, I guess less than 10 to Chelan, which I thought was a big city when I moved here in the 60s.
Yeah, I had an experience like that in the 60s, went from the outdoor plumbing to the indoor. It was a wonderful experience, especially in the wintertime. What did you study in school at the junior high level then? Is it similar to what we study today?
Oh, I think so. We had history, English, geography, math, and some science. We didn't have laboratories, art. We didn't have music program at the time. They had a vocal music, 1 hour a week or something. It was during about 37 or 8 that... Dad, that's a good story. Cap Udy had his own private band here, and he was not a teacher, but Dad some way went to Olympia and got him some special certification to teach band, because the first high school band started about 38, I would guess, 37, 38.
Is that right? I remember seeing articles in the paper about Cap Ruby's band and recruiting band members, and I think Kenny Kingman wrote some editorials complimenting him on the town band and so on.
Well, the grade school is now was a city park, a block square city park, and in the center of it had a bandstand. So one of the first memories I have of Chelan was we came here and we lived right at the city corner from there, and in the evening Cap Ruby's band would have a concert in that park once a week in the summer.
Was that a well-attended event for the whole town?
Oh, I think, as I recall, it was quite well-attended.
Yeah.
You know, kind of a social event, and people would go, and the band would play for an hour or two on some evening, Friday evening, whatever evening it was, I don't recall.
You know, 1935 was not the economic zenith of the United States. We were in the middle of a depression, and did that depression affect your life much, Charlie?
Well, I, of course, was a child. I didn't realize. I now, thinking back, realize how dirt poor we were. Dad had been superintendent of schools in Ephrata, and I think it was probably in 32, they just automatically, to keep the school open, cut all school salaries in half. So Dad went from $180 a month to superintendent of schools to $90 a month to superintendent of schools.
Mm-hmm.
And then... the warrants, they were paid by warrants that were that banks wouldn't accept. And so people either had to discount the warrants or people buying discounted warrants and so forth. So it was tough. We had our garden and our chickens, and we didn't live well on that. But Dad had a monthly income, at least, or at least for 9 months of the year, and we were better off than a whole lot of people in that day.
Yeah. So when you got here, it was probably a substantially better move, I would
Well, I assume that, I don't know what the salary was, I assume it was much, much better, and the town was in a depression, and no question about it. Apples weren't selling. I think in that fall of 35, they had an early freeze, and the apples at that time, they picked them and left them standing in the orchards until they could swamp them out in the boxes to the warehouse, and the apples closed in orchards. There were orchardists that tried to move them into the house and to save their apple crop, store them inside their their home, and the weight of the apples broke down the foundation, so they lost not only their crop, but their house.
Yeah. Talking this morning with Judge Charles Cohen and about life in Chelan and the Depression, and a bit about his father, and we're going to take a commercial break here, and then we'll come back and talk some more in a moment. Thank you, Steve. Our guest this morning is Judge Charles Cohen.
Charlie,
I had what we were talking about here off the air struck a responsive chord. We were talking to Lil Fisher the other day, and Lil was a native of Minnesota, and I was a native of Wisconsin. She and I were talking about how things seem so bleak out here, even in the Chelan Valley. There's no color or anything compared to what we had, and you were talking about the comparison to Ephrata.
Oh yeah, when first time I ever saw Chelan was when we were in our car driving in to live here, and I can remember how thrilled I was as coming into Chelan and seeing the lake, and my brother and I had always tried to camp and hike and around Ephrata and those sagebrush hills, and Ephrata was a town of 600 and a wind-blown desert town in those days, and we came here and saw the trees and the valleys and the area, and I could hardly wait to get out of that car and get up and look down on what was here, and plan a camping trip where there was pine boughs and trees and maybe springs. And I think that for summer we camped out at Godfrey Canyon, which is up here above Chelan Apple Orchard.
Mm-hmm.
It was a thrill. Ephrata in those days was just a desert, dried up, wind-blown, dust-storm town.
Yeah. Well, see, one man's garden is another man's
desert.
This
was a garden. This was a Garden of Eden to me when I moved to Chelan.
Yeah.
And I think my whole family. Mother enjoyed it. We all thought we were coming to heaven when we saw Chelan.
But, you know, your father was a very public man. I came to know him, if you will, by reading the old newspapers here, and it seems that just about every week, especially into the World War II era at least, there was something about your father. I think he was active in the Chamber of Commerce. I'd like to find more about his the non-public Charles Cohen, but for a lot of our listeners who weren't here then, let's talk about what kinds of things did he get involved in? Why, what makes a man so active as he was?
Well, he came from a family, a farm family of seven brothers, sisters, and all of them sought education. He has three or four brothers who have doctor's degrees and taught at universities, and Dad had that thirst for knowledge, and he was a historian, knew languages, German, French, and English.
Mm-hmm.
He was a scientist. He was adept at botany and biology. He taught chemistry and physics and math in school, and especially during the war years when they were short of teachers. Whatever they didn't have a teacher for, Dad would teach and could teach.
Mm-hmm.
He had hobbies. He always carried a specimen can with him, as I remember, and would collect and identify and keep botany and biology specimens. He was sought out by people in this community and other communities for answers to problems. People would find a snake and want to know what kind of it is delivered to our house, or a type of mushroom, or a bug, entomology. He had a collection of spiders that people would bring in. I think the first time we ever saw a black widow spider in this area, someone had found it and asked him to identify it. He had a interest in that. He also was greatly interested in public affairs, politics, and so forth. He used to say that, I remember, he said, I'd hate to die during election year before the results came in, because he didn't think he could stand
knowing
what might have happened.
Well, I know he was a pretty strong Republican. My guess would be that he was, anyway, based on some of the articles I saw him write, or articles he wrote that I saw.
He tended to be Republican. He ran for state legislature as a Republican in Chelan County in 1944, I think it was, during the war years.
Mm-hmm.
But he was certainly not on the conservative wing. I think he'd be on the moderate wing of the Republican Party. If that means anything, and he could be very liberal in many instances, especially those involving education and civil rights. He was an advocate of free speech.
You know, he was a very busy man in his profession, and yet, as we mentioned, I think he was active in the Chamber of Commerce. How do you find time for this stuff? Did you ever see your dad? It seems to me when I look in the paper, he would always been working at a community project.
I think that's one regret that myself and my other brothers and sisters have, that when we moved to Chelan especially, it was a change in our lives and a change in his. The responsibilities of this spreading district were greater, and actually we saw less of him through the teen and high school years than we had as a child, as I recall. Maybe Mother recalled something different. He would come home and say, we're going someplace, and we'd pack up and go to Stevens Pass for a few days to pick huckleberries camping out. He was available, and I think the times we had were, family times we had were good. So it's really not the quantity, it's the quality of your association that counts.
Yeah. When I've read the papers, I think the articles that have maybe fascinated me the most were those that he wrote immediately after World War II began. Well, first of all, let me ask you one we ask most people. What were you doing on December 7th of 1941?
Dad and I were walking home from church, Methodist Church, where it's presently located, and a friend of ours, mine, a classmate of mine, Dave Furman, was working in the Plymouth Garage, which is now where the Shell Station is on Main Street here, and Dave Furman came running out and said the Japs had bombed Pearl Harbor. And Dad and I started running, and we ran. We lived down the lake above the dam down there. We ran down and turned on the radio, and for the rest of the day, we spent listening to the radio. It was, you never forget that. That's one thing. You know, Kennedy's death, I can tell you right where I was, Pearl Harbor.
You were in high school then, right?
Yes.
Okay. How did you react to that? Did you react with fear? Were people saying, are they going to attack the West Coast? What went through
your mind? I don't think we were really fearful of it. There was an immediate reaction, but there certainly wasn't panic. I think all of them, I was a senior in high school. I think all of us immediately assumed that started making our plans on how we were going to enter the service, because all the boys in my class knew right then that was going to happen.
Yeah.
I remember saying once to my brother, I hope this war's over before I have to go. And he made some remark, well, that's a brave statement.
Yeah.
He joined the Marines. Funny about it.
I'm at Sunday. Most people can remember that we've talked to listening to the radio all day, but they don't really remember a lot about what was said. Do you remember what kind of coverage there was available?
There was reports of the bombing. The full extent of it was covered up for a long time. It was months or maybe a year after before we found that the whole pursuit had depleted and virtually wiped out at Pearl Harbor. There was lots of reports of individual heroism that had happened. You know, I think maybe that first day we heard of Colin Kelly, who had shot down a Japanese plane over Pearl Harbor and died doing it. There was a lot of statements about how the government was organizing to meet who was being called into the White House. Of course, coverage wasn't as good then, but they kept up a running account of what was going on in Washington, what President Roosevelt was doing about it. The next morning, we had an assembly in high school, called us all in, and he made his speech.
The day that we'll live in infamy, speech.
And we sat in assembly in high school from that.
Do you remember that assembly well?
Yes.
What was the atmosphere there?
Well, it was hushed and concerned, and we knew we were at war, and we didn't know how bad it was at the time. Americans, even though we weren't prepared, didn't know we weren't prepared, and we were confident to look out, but also concerned that a lot of us were going to have to face the bullets. And I think the mothers and fathers were more concerned than the young people were. The young people, you know, were...
Yeah, they'd been through the other one.
There were members of our class that immediately enlisted or did within a week or two or a month or two. It was a time to go.
Now, the articles that your father wrote appeared for a while, I'm not sure how long, on a weekly basis in the Mirror. And do you remember him writing those or seeing them? Because they're really fascinating at times.
I can't remember any of those individual articles. I'm sure if he wrote them, I must have read them.
Yeah. But the general thrust of many of them was really quite critical of the military. You know, we look at movies now and that were made in that era, and it seems that everybody was in agreement. We were all going to. But he was especially the early campaigns in the South Pacific. He was saying, "Why weren't we ready there?" and that kind of thing.
Well, Dad was very critical of the military. We were going through a series of defeats. You know, there wasn't any good news militarily about the Japanese invasion of
the whole Pacific area.
Asia. And the British were losing their battleships, I forget which ones, off of Singapore, and Singapore was taken, and many of those places were taken with only token resistance. Even the Philippines, it was almost token. I hate to say that to the people who were there, but...
There were enough of them there to be more than a token.
There wasn't enough of them, badly equipped and so forth, and I don't recall the articles Dad wrote, but he's used this statement many times to me, and it irked me because I thought we're doing the best we can. But he said, you know, our whole military posture is too little, too late, and that he repeated that several times over the dinner table or when we're talking about events, and that
he used it in the article too. He used it in the article too. What was it like then to finish high school that year? Were there differences in your in the high school life after December 7th?
Well, I made a speech at my high school graduation, a very poor one, and I forgot it in the middle and so forth, but my speech was the thing we all know we're going in the service, you know, that some of us probably aren't coming back, and then a confident statement that, you know, we'll do what we have to be done, and I know it was a custom to have a senior sneak, and Dad was of the opinion that with the hard times of the war and sacrifices, we shouldn't do this. And my sister and I were in the class, and he tried to get us to advocate to that class that we not do that. I refused to do that, I know, and my sister did. So we went, but he always thought that was a waste in the time of war for us to waste the time of a sneak and to waste the expense of taking the speedway that he can do. It was austere, and I think we didn't have the fun, the celebration of graduation that other classes before and after had, because some of our class had already gone, you know.
Yeah.
Several of the boys had already left for service.
Yeah, I would imagine it would have been a damper on social life. We better take another commercial break here before I forget to do it. We're talking with Judge Charles Cohn, and we'll come back and talk some more live through the clock break in a few moments. I get going now.
Dad, you remember the war? You remember Pearl Harbor Day?
Oh, yes. I hadn't gone to church that day. I was at home, starting dinner.
It's funny how you can remember that yesterday.
Wasn't dad planned summer school so some of the boys could get...
I went to summer school that summer.
He ran a summer school and some could finish their credits.
They also wanted us to learn math and physics. They said, you know, they need engineers. So Mr. Lanier taught a bunch of us. We'd thin apples 12 hours a day and go to school at night and study in physics and advanced physics and chemistry and everything. Because there was some program that's what the military needed.
We'll talk about that. We should be on here in a second. And again, we're talking with Judge Charles Cohn about his father and about life here in the Lake Chelan Valley in the late 30s and through the early 40s, the early part of World War II. Charlie, one of the things that I've seen in the papers concerning the schools in the early stages of the war was a great deal of uncertainty about how they could continue to operate, whether there'd be enough gasoline to operate buses and so on. What were the mechanical effects, if you will, on the school system?
Well, I think they always got enough gasoline to operate the buses and enough tires, but immediately when the war started, and even before, things were getting short. So there was conservation measures. There was a curtailment of interscholastic activities during the war years. We went to, the year after I left, they went to intramural programs and so forth, with some minor interscholastic activity. There was, by the time I finished high school in the spring of 42, there was a shortage of teachers. The teachers were leaving as well as the students. And I think there were times, that's when Dad had to go to work and teach chemistry. The chemistry teachers left before the year was out. The rest of them left immediately following. So I don't know. I wasn't here then in 43 and 44, but I know it was a difficult time manning the school, and they went to intramural conservation measures of a lot of the school activities during those years.
Well, you and your mother were mentioning in our commercial break there that there were some special classes taught and that kind of thing. I hadn't known about that.
In the summer of 42, because some students wanted to finish and weren't ready to finish, and the Army or the, I don't know who declared it, thought that those going to service should be better prepared in math, physics, and chemistry. Dad started a summer school evening program, and many of us went. Some of them to get their degree, diploma, before they had to go to the service, and some of us preparing in these fields that we had not been sufficiently trained in during the regular year. So, gee, I can remember all of that summer of 42. We worked in the orchards, thinning 10, 12 hours a day, and then we'd go to class at night. Mrs. Rainier and some of the other teachers taught us the class. Bill Borowski, who's here, was in that class, Art Camel. And we took a quarter of, I think, math and physics and maybe some chemistry during that summer. I did.
So there's a lot of extra time put in there.
Yes. And then there were others that were specially tutored to the point where they would get their degree or their diploma, even though they had finished that year and didn't have enough credits, or maybe some of them made up a whole senior year so they could get that diploma. I think the school probably fudged a little on the requirements to give some people a diploma so they could go into the service with a high school diploma.
When I think about the Second World War, and I talk to people who were in the service then, sometimes I have a feeling that there's a once-over lightly effect there when they're talking about it. You know, people don't talk too much about the feelings that they had the day they went in or whatever. They talk about the good times they had. I suppose all of us do that. But you went into the service, didn't you?
Yeah.
Okay. What kind of a feeling was it to say, I'm going into the service in a time when the whole world's at war?
Well, I don't know. I think we prepared for it. I was 17 when the war started, so I had almost a year to March of 42. two before I had to worry about it. It was just something we went. The country in that war was, it wasn't like the Korean War where there was some much doubt about our commitment. Mm-hmm. It wasn't like the Vietnam War where there was at least a 50-50 split as to the thing. We were, the country, the community, the people were wholly dedicated to winning that war. And those who were not were not treated too well. You know, it was a total commitment by everyone to do. I mean, the people at home saving, you saved your bacon grease, you saved your toothpaste tubes. Because of the metal things, we had a big pile right down here on the street where everyone turned in their old, searched the whole county for old rubber tires for reclaiming. You know, it was a commitment. And so going in was something you really kind of looked forward to. You know, it was time to go. And
the commitment was a psychological boost enough that it worked, some of the fear level.
Well, there was always a concern. Every time you moved to a new outfit or got closer to the front, the shivers went more up your back. But
tell us a little bit about your service. What did you do in the war?
Well, I did a lot of things. I went in and took basic training at Camp Roberts. I went to UCLA. They sent me under an Army specialized training program studying physics, chemistry, you know, hoped to be an engineer. It was really a holding position for a lot of infantry troops to until the Second Front opened up. That's what it was, and to keep the colleges open and occupied during that period. Then I was in North Carolina, and I volunteered for overseas duty, and it turned out to be the Office of Strategic Services, which was the forerunner of the CIA. And then I went to Burma and operated behind the Japanese lines in Burma for about a year.
What do you mean, operated behind the lines? So
behind the lines.
Hide in the woods and watch
the woods
or what?
The valleys run north and south in Burma, and the British troops were advancing south down those valleys, and we were on the behind the lines on the peaks, giving them information and sabotaging and so forth with this Burmese guerrilla. Troops were fully organized and equipped and fought with.
That must have been a little hair-raising at times, wasn't it?
Well, I think it sounds that way, but actually we were much safer than people on the organized fronts because we could run, we could hide,
and they couldn't. Yeah.
And no one 500 miles away on the radio could say a charge because they didn't know where we were or anything. So it was psychologically, you know, fearful, a lot of fear, but because you're surrounded all the time. But it wasn't really dangerous. We didn't have to go under artillery packs and air attacks and all of the mean things that happened on the European front.
Different kind of stress.
Yeah.
How did you get in there and get out of there?
Well, some of them jumped. They flew me in a light plane 500 miles at treetops and landed on a prepared strip and kicked me out. My plane took off, and I'm standing in the middle of this by myself, and some natives come out of the sea and hand me a note and said, follow me. He followed me. I followed him to an organized group.
What kind of training did it take for you to get into that kind of position?
Well, I've been in engineers before, and they trained us. I was a demolition man. I had been through demolition school. And then they took us to Catalina Island and gave us a lot of underwater training. They didn't know where we were going at the time. They trained us weapons, underwater training, mapping, and survival. That was a big part of it. You know, they turned you loose with a handful of rice on Catalina Island for thing, and you have to map certain places. That's what it was. A lot of hand-to-hand combat training. And
tried to prepare you for about anything they could assign you to do. Is there any such thing as a typical day in your life behind the lines? Can you give us an idea of what you...
Well, we were organizing a group of maybe about 200 Burmese with a lieutenant, a radio operator, a medic, and either two or three of us who were kind of commanding the troops.
Mm-hmm.
We were all enlisted men, low enlisted men, but And then we would patrol, watch, ambush, send back intelligence. Everything, you know, all the time we're down there, all our supplies came by airdrop and by buying from the natives, rice and beef and vegetables.
What was your diet like when you had for breakfast?
In Burma, every meal is rice and curry, you know, vegetable curry or meat curry, whatever meat you have is rice and curry every meal, tea.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we got tea rations, we got and when we got airdropped in, we got some better food sometimes. I remember one time they flew over, they were dropping this new mask. There was a light plane came in, and they dropped us about 12 loaves of freshly baked bread that they baked something. And we got on those, you know, we hadn't eaten anything but these dry crackers for 6 months. And we had some butter then, it wasn't worth a darn. It was, wouldn't melt, you know, but it wouldn't melt in your mouth either.
Yeah.
It wouldn't melt. So we had butter and peanut butter, and I think 4 or 5 or 6 American oil, that we ate those 12 loaves of bread and butter and peanut butter just as fast as we could get them down. A loaf at a time. It was just so good. I remember that as one of the greatest dietary or gourmet meals that I ever had in my life, was that fresh bread and peanut butter.
You know, you mentioned that dropping supplies in it. Just as a layman, if I were behind enemy lines and I saw a plane coming over to drop supplies for me, I would say, get out of here, you're telling everybody where I am.
Well, we moved fast, you know, we'd set up a drop, we'd have a panel drop, and the radio would contact them where to drop them, we'd drop them, gather them up as quickly as possible, and vanish as quickly as possible. We never stayed slow. Lots of times we would make camp, have dinner, and then move a mile or two away and see the jungle or the country. And we'd hear them shooting up where we were camped after we got away, you know, because they'd pack a knife easily.
Yeah.
So we didn't, that was always a concern. You're out there and plane circling, dropping parachutes, there's a pretty good indication that the enemy is there to the Japanese.
Yeah, it's like sending a telegram, yeah. I bet they didn't have to encourage you to hustle, did they? You talk about making camp. Obviously, you didn't have a nice barracks to live in. What, to live in tents for the whole time, or what?
Jungle hammock, camped out. But the natives there, especially where in the bamboo forest, they can make you a house in an hour, you know, out of bamboo.
Uh-huh.
And they go in and patch you up. And so you lived rather comfortable. They're resourceful people. We had elephants, we had ox carts to haul our supplies when we could. Sometimes we haul them away. I hauled a pack on my back with a mortar plate on it up and down those mountains.
Have you ever wanted to go back there?
Oh, yeah. In fact, my outfit, Detachment 101 of OSS, still has an organization, kind of a presence organization, and they were planning a year or two ago a trip back to Burma. And I don't know what happened to it. Mainly, we couldn't get in to Michinaw and north where with Bama, where we had been, and that, because they said that they couldn't guarantee our safety. Burma has been in revolt and ever since World War II, different things. So they said that they just couldn't let us go in there. And most of us never got to Rangoon, and going back to Rangoon was what we wanted to do.
Well, didn't you tell them you were trained to handle that kind of thing?
No, I wouldn't want to train with that again.
We're talking this morning with Judge Charles Cohen. And we'll come back and talk some more live from the crockery in a few moments.
Oh, that's all right. That's, you know, that's kind of the fun of these things. Oh, thanks, John. Yeah, thanks, Rachel. I'll give him a call. That's the portentous we had yesterday.
Oh.
The son of John Hubbard.
Oh, yeah.
Do you have a particular time?
No. How far you going and how far you want to go. How far it is.
Did you tell them you had to have an interpreter?
Oh, yeah.
And when you needed the interpreter, he'd be far away.
Yes. I can imagine. I knew a guy in the Army that sat on a hillside outside of a pond on the river and watched the flip was falling down at the dock.
Thank you, Steve. We're sitting here today with Judge Charles Conan, who sort of wandered the field a bit and gotten into some interesting service life. So, Charlie, when the war was over, did you come back to Chelan at all, or when your service in the war was complete?
Yes, I came back and was here for a while, and then went back to college. I got out in October of 45, and took my leisure coming home. In fact, I stopped in Denver and a few places visiting friends. And then I arrived here in December, went to work in a furniture store here until February, I think, and then I went to Whitman College.
When you were leisurely coming home, what kind of reception did you get from folks as a serviceman?
Well, getting off the boat in New York, they had boats around us with entertainers. Took us to a camp, had German prisoners. This was midnight or after when we finally got to Fort Hamilton in Brooklyn. And they had German prisoners there, fed us a steak dinner, and, you know, everything was fine. And we went down to Washington, D.C. to get discharged. And it was, you know, there wasn't any special note. The servicemen were, by that time, the war had been over long enough, so the headlines would say, ex-serviceman commits robbery or something like that. They don't get the blush had worn off of the original returnees. There weren't any parades or anything like that. We were in uniform. We were treated kindly. We all wore what they called the ruptured dust. That meant there was a insignia of a discharged soldier.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I don't know if we got any special treatment. We got home here, and I know the Legion organized a little party for a bunch of us that got here in the evening, dinner, and so forth.
Charlie, this is maybe a little bit out of the field of heritage strictly, but the thought occurs to me there is a good deal of publicity now about the difficulties that Vietnam-era veterans are having in adjusting to life in the United States now, and problems that are showing up 10, 12 years after their involvement. Were there those kinds of adjustment difficulties that were encountered by World War II vets?
Oh, yeah, but I think, number one, the World War II vet had knowledge that, one, they'd won a war. Two, the people had been 100% behind them while they were doing it. And three, I think the Vietnam War was such a discouraging thing, so brutal. You know, new weapons, new things, the hopelessness of it, that it must have been, and the brutality of it, and the brutality they participated in, it was hard. You know, it's one thing to fight a war, it's another thing to fight it beyond the normal concept of what is fair and right, and whether the whole prospect of being there is fair and right. I don't think that they say that they didn't do anything. I think they're covered by GI benefits. They drifted home over such a long period of time, over 10 years. So the fact that there wasn't any great outpouring of parades and welcome home to them is understandable. It was a different war. They flew over there in a day, were in the front lines the next day, got their time in and flew home from many by commercial airline and landed, and there wasn't any organized division coming home on a boat to be welcomed.
You know, that's the fact that hadn't occurred to me. They call it debriefing now, you know, when you get out of a war zone or whatever, they send you to maybe possibly to a counselor that talks to you for a couple hours and you're on your way. But you guys debriefed yourselves.
Yes, there was no
had all kinds of time to talk about adjustments.
They gave you your checkout pay, your final physical, did what things they had to do, tried to re-enlist you in the reserve, and gave you your travel pay, and home you came. There wasn't any, as far as I know, any real concern about how it affected us psychologically. Although it did, many people, I suppose. I think it affected more World War II veterans alcoholically than it did any other way, because they had been in a atmosphere to them was where alcohol consumption was a way of relaxation.
Yeah.
More than they had when they left the farms to go.
Yeah. And of course, the time in transit from the theaters of war gave a person a chance to sort of come down.
Yeah.
Let's go back a little bit in time. First of all, have you ever had the opportunity to examine the old papers about what was going on here while you were away, or talk to your parents about that kind of thing? Or did anything surprise you? I guess this is what I'm getting to, when you got home, about what had happened at home while you were gone.
Well, I had a sister in Virginia who was in high school during most of those years, and we corresponded, so I knew what was going on on the home front, and of course my parents wrote me about things that were going on, and I knew when someone from Chelan died in the service, and I knew of the gas rationing and so forth. And I knew that because when I was in the States, if we got a long enough pass, we could get gas coupons.
Yeah.
And you could get cigarettes. And with gas coupons and cigarettes, you could spend a weekend in Los Angeles without spending a nickel.
Sure. A little bartering here and there.
Yeah. I stood out at in Riverside, California, and 100 soldiers lined up to get a ride into Los Angeles or wherever they're going for the weekend. Held up a pack of Camels and had cars bump fenders.
Okay, I got road delivered.
And giving them a ride.
You know, there was an ad that the Chevron Oil Company, Standard Oil, I guess, was it, put in the local paper that said, "Keep the benches empty." That caught my eye here. The Standard Oil stations across the country put out benches for servicemen to sit on, and the ad pitch was, "Stop your car and pick up the serviceman." A lot of things flashed through my mind about the...
I hitchhiked all over when I was in the service. I was at UCLA, and we never thought of taking a bus. It only cost a dime, but we never even considered taking a bus to go anyplace at any time, day or night.
When you got home, I'm sure you had the opportunity to sit and talk with your father about telling your experiences and so on. What did he think about the way the war had gone and so on?
Well, I think he was pleased, hopeful of that now we had gotten a lasting situation of peace. Greatly concerned about the then unknown consequences of atomic explosions. We discussed, and I remember with my father and with my uncle, who was a chemistry professor at University of Idaho, the possibility of a chain reaction of exploding one of those without knowing its potential and setting a reaction that would destroy the world. And I was greatly assured when Uncle Bill said he didn't think that was potentially possible.
You know, to a lot of young people today, they may hear that and say that's kind of a ridiculous thing, but the people who invented the bomb were extremely concerned about that happening.
They didn't know what it would do if they built a bigger one, or if something went wrong with the ones they already were exploding.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What did your dad do when he got out of the education business?
Well, he got out of that during the war. He was hired by some organization in this valley to bring labor into Chelan County to harvest the fruit. They were having trouble. And I don't know if people remember it, but trainloads of families came to Wenatchee from Arkansas and Oklahoma, and Dad was in charge of finding them housing and work in this valley. And
yeah, I've seen something about that.
And many of our citizens now who own our orchards and work in our plants and are our leading citizens came on those trains to Wenatchee in 44, 45.
Mm-hmm.
And that was then after that he went to work after the war, and I don't know the exact time sequence of this because I was gone. He went to work for the Columbia Basin Commission, where it was his job to get every farmer in the basin to sign a contract with the Reclamation Interior Department. So he traveled the entire basin, called on every farmer in the basin, and signed up the contracts for the water from that project.
Yeah.
And then at one time, I know Mother wrote me and said, "Hallelujah, Dad's coming home." And he quit that job and was coming home, and then he spent his greater time substitute teaching and some more teaching in Chelan High School until his eventual retirement. So he was then 70 when he finally gave that up. In the meantime, he was Justice of the Peace and ran the Chamber of Commerce Tourist Bureau and did things like that. He never was unbusy.
Do you have a favorite story to tell about your dad from the times when you were a kid? A particular time you got in trouble, anything like that?
Well, there were so many times.
You mentioned, I'll let you speak about that for a while, but you mentioned that you and your brothers liked camp and so on. When you got here in the 30s, did you have a favorite campsite here?
In summers, I don't know, hiked the area from South Navarre to Cub Lake and Surprise Lake, and those trips were our favorites, I guess. And you know, it's amazing now that I do that. I have the nylon equipment and downs and tents and so forth. We took a square of canvas and a pack sack, sometimes even carried a horseshoe roll over our shoulders. I know one time we spent, I think, 13 days wandering from Navarre to all of those lakes, Eagle Lakes on the Methouse side, Crater Lake, you know, Surprise Lake, and down with Wayne Kelly. He was with us.
Mm-hmm. Was it different to be out there then than it is now? Did you see more game or less game or anything like that?
Well, I remember seeing bears up above Surprise Lake when we were picking huckleberries. I assume there was more. There were fewer people. Mm-hmm. Campsites were messier because in those days anyone had an empty can, just dump it. You know, we didn't haul out anything, but we didn't realize the impact wasn't that great. There were people did it every year, but there weren't as many doing it.
Okay, we're talking with Judge Charles Cohen, and we'll come back with some final comments or whatever in just a moment, but we'll take another commercial break here first.
They questioned the childless chairman of the Red Cross. There were so many needing help, and the Red Cross didn't have any money. So he ran about our money, and we didn't have any.
Okay, thank you very much, Steve. We're here this morning with Judge Charles Cohen. And, Charlie, you know, when we called you and talked to you the other day, mentioned I wanted to talk about your father, and I found so many different areas to go into. I asked you a while ago if there was a favorite story you had of some mischief you might have done when you were a youngster, but I think what I was getting to was, most of us who can read now in the old papers or do research work or whatever, we see the public, Charles Cohen, the guy who was organizing laborers to come in and trying to keep the school system going. Would you classify your father as a lenient man, or was he a strict disciplinarian in the home?
He was quite strict with our behavior, I think.
He challenged us to do our best. He was interested in high academic achievement, which I don't think any of us satisfied his expectations or desires in that field. He was not harsh to get along with. He enjoyed whatever time we spent together, I think. And I'd say he was a good father. I'm glad I had him. I'm glad to have the association.
What kind of things would you do? Did you hunt and fish together? Well,
we didn't hunt. I was never a hunter, and Dad never hunted much. He'd take us fishing. We went on family picnics. We, as I said, huckleberried. We took trips, you know. I can remember our family going in a Model A Ford, six of us in a Model A Ford from Ephrata to Minnesota and back one summer, and we visited every place along the way. Mount Rushmore, which they were just starting to chip.
Oh, yeah.
Yellowstone Park, the Black Hills, Badlands, and we spent the summer in Minnesota fishing every day in the thousand lakes that Minnesota has, and every many times, he, being a teacher, would have some time in the summer, and we'd go to his family's area in southern Idaho and visit and work on the farms down there in the summer. He was never one to be idle. You know, when he went to visit his brother's farm, Dad would stack the hay and pitch the hay, and he'd see we kids were weeding the beets and so forth. It was no idle times. Idle times were not acceptable, yeah. Really. But it was fun, you know. Being busy is the way to spend your time.
Yeah. Charlie, I really appreciate you coming to talk with us this morning.
It's been my pleasure, really.
Very enjoyable.
I'm glad we didn't let Mother talk more. I mean, I'm sorry you didn't let Mother talk.
Well, maybe next year. We've been talking this morning with Judge Charles Cohen, Superior Court Judge, and that should about do it for today from the Crockery. We'll be coming back, though, as the month of March draws to a close. Hope you can all stay with us. How about that, Judge?
Thank you.
All right. I really enjoyed it.